She hails from Birmingham, Alabama, but yet in 1988 entered the Louisiana State University and actually became SGA president for the 1991-92 term. She even had to cancel Free Speech Alley, maybe for the first time ever, during the Louisiana governor's race. She called helping get the university license plate scholarship program through the state legislature her biggest accomplishment as SGA president. "Every time I pass a car with a university license plate, I feel a sense of accomplishment," she said. She loved Baton Rouge so much, she decided to stay, and now is running for the Metro Council in District 11. The Freeman Report, uncensored. I'm honored to have today as my guest on the Freeman Report, Lori White Adams, who is running for Metro Council, District 11, as I said. Welcome to the Freeman Report, Lori.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So, by the way, just a quick question. Do you know where Sean Ardway is these days?
Oh, my goodness, yes. He is in the Lafayette area, and he is quite an accomplished Zydeco musician.
So, that is him.
Absolutely. That's him. Yes, Grammy nominated last year. He is a very...
He was the VP, correct? When you were the president of the SGA, he was the VP. I just didn't know if y'all kept in touch or anything like that. So
through Facebook.
But
through
anyway, Facebook. So coming from Birmingham, where my business partner lives now part-time, great city. What made you decide to go to LSU?
Well, I came for the very good reason of a boy. Believe it or not, yes, my husband and I met in 1985. I was 12 and he was 15, and our grandparents had lake houses next to each other in Lake Martin, Alabama. And we started a summer romance that was letters and phone calls during the school year, and he came to a few dances in Birmingham, and I was able to come down to Baton Rouge to visit him a few times. And I was going to go to Auburn University, where my whole family went, and just kind of at the last minute, I realized I wanted to come to Baton Rouge, come to LSU, where he was a student, and see if things were going to work out between us. And I still, to this day, find it amazing that my parents were willing to let me follow a boy to college, because now that I have kids that age, if they asked me, I would, no, you're not following a boy or a girl to college. But my parents trusted me, and, thought we had something special, and so 28 years of marriage and two children later, it was the right decision for many reasons.
Well, that's great. That is fantastic, and we're glad you decided to stay. And I want to welcome for the first time on the Freeman Report as well, my daughter Jamie, who knows more about podcasting than I do, but she was one that actually went away to UCF in Orlando and decided to come back to Baton Rouge. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into it. But welcome, Jamie.
Thanks, Dad. Or should I say Kenny? I don't know how to call you.
You can call me whatever you want in here. So, do you get back to Birmingham often, or do you...
Not as often as I would like, just a couple times a year. We still have a place on Lake Martin, Alabama, and so we try to get up there during the summer when it's cooler and it's beautiful, and just to get to visit family. So I still have some family left in Birmingham. Actually, most of my family's left in Birmingham, so I do try to get up there and see everybody.
Well, that's good that you get back and go see family and stuff.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
And I bring that up because I remember Birmingham back in the 50s and 60s was really more of a steel mill town. I mean, it was considered the Pittsburgh
Absolutely.
Of the South. I mean, they made steel production. I think they were the second largest city in the country
Absolutely.
As far as steel production.
Yes.
But then the steel production moved offshore.
It did, and
actually went to other countries. Korea, China started making it. And so both Pittsburgh and Birmingham somewhat lost their key industry.
Absolutely.
But the thing to me about Birmingham is they've rebuilt themselves. They brought in new industry. It's a
yes.
great city to visit. I mean, I go there sometimes with a group of guys. We'll go to the LSU Alabama or LSU Auburn game and stay there.
Yeah.
And it's very clean now. It's a very beautiful city.
It is.
So it kind of brings me a little bit to here's Birmingham over here that rebuilt itself. And Baton Rouge, I've lived here virtually my entire life, grew up here. I think we're still trying to find our identity.
Yes.
I remember we've come up with slogans probably every 4, 5, 6 years They don't seem to stick. We can't find our identity. Whereas I think, again, Birmingham now is a viable city. What can we do maybe to, what are your thoughts on maybe kind of moving Baton Rouge towards something like that?
We have definitely struggled. I mean, the oil and gas industry, the petrochemical industry have been, the foundation of our economy for a long time. When Stephen Morey was here at the Department of Economic Development, I know he was very focused on diversifying our economy, especially with regard to technology. And we got the IBM Center, but it does feel like some of that has faltered since he's left. I think the things that are really holding us back are some of the quality of life issues that we know we have. Our public education system has made some strides. We're making some improvements, but we're not where we need to be. When I have, through my work with schools, when I have gone to different fairs where we're trying to attract other businesses here or attract professionals to come and live in Baton Rouge, they look at the education system first, and, we're telling them, we have a great private education system, but you need to plan, $15,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year of your family budget for private school.
Right,
that's a hard pill to swallow. Also, I would say the number of murders that we're having in our city and being named one of the top 10 deadliest cities.
Top four. We're going to get into crime in a little bit, but Baton Rouge is considered the fourth most unsafe city in the country right now, by one study anyway, so.
I think those are the things that are holding us back because I know it's not our people. Our people are incredibly talented. We have a very diverse culture here. We have a wonderful culture here. I think it's these things that are holding us back, not the people that we have here.
Right. And Jamie's boss, David Tapman, actually sits on the school board, and I look at the school board, and I don't think there's a whole lot that the city council necessarily can do. But sure. When I look at the school board, East Baton Rouge Parish School Board, and their budget is like $460 million. That's, what the budget of Birmingham is total?
No, I don't.
$450 million.
Wow.
And Baton Rouge, just the budget for Baton Rouge, East Baton Rouge Parish, granted, it's parish, not
right.
city.
Right.
But Baton Rouge is over $1 billion
That's
now.
Right. That's right.
And you say, and the school board is outside of that. So I agree with you. We've got to do something on the public education side. I mean, so you went to a private school here in high school, but what do you think about the public education system?
Well, that's kind of hard to talk about when my boss is on the board, but I definitely think there's room for improvement. I have a friend who lives here in Baton Rouge. She's lived here her whole life, and she's always said when she has kids she wants to move to Texas because she wants to raise her kids in a state that has good public education. And it's hard to blame somebody for that, but we're improving. Obviously we're getting better, but we have a long way to go.
Yeah, agreed. We are improving. I mean, I've been, I thought when Warren Drake came on, lot of the moves that he made were really good. As long as we can continue on that trajectory, the problem is you don't turn it around quickly. On last year's campaign trail, when I was running for state rep of District 68,
right.
People would ask me, and I'd say, I'm going to be honest with you, it's going to take a generation. It's going to take a full generation to get our school system where we want it to be. And that nobody wants to hear that, but
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I'm a product of the public education system here. I went to Terre High, and Mike, who we had on earlier, went to Broadmoor. When you look at, and I've always told somebody at the Baton Rouge Business Report, they ought to do an article one time, and I think they actually did one at one point. I can go to Westdale Junior High, where there was Matt McKay, who owns the All-Star, John Enquist with Head and Enquist, Jay Darden was in that class. Johnny Fife, who runs I can just go down the line. Half of them went to Terre, and the other half went to Baton Rouge High.
Right.
But the public school system back then it was really, really great. Matter of fact, my brother, I guess I can give him a little bit of a plug now, my older brother went to Baton Rouge High and then became a Rhodes Scholar. So,
wow.
It's I think my father-in-law said I was one too, but it was spelled R-O-A-D-S. So that's my good old father. So you did mention, though, Laurie, And before I get into this question, why don't you just go ahead and tell us a little bit more about you and what you've been doing, you know, since you graduated from LSU and decided to stay here.
Absolutely. I've done quite a few things. I went after I got my bachelor's in journalism. I got my master's in public administration with a focus on public budgeting and the economics of healthcare. And then from there, I worked for a state senator for a while who was very focused, Senator Mike Branch. He represented part of Baton Rouge and part of Livingston, and he was very, very focused on the Comeat River Diversion Canal at that point because the flooding that had taken place in Baton Rouge in the 80s had been so severe, and he knew that the Comeat Diversion Canal would be a big part of helping that not happen again. After finished working for him, I believe it or not, I owned a maternity store for a few years, which was great when my kids were little. I've always wanted to own my own store, and it was a terrific experience. And then sold that in 2000 after my daughter was born. Having two kids and a shop was a little more than I could do. And then in 2004, my kids were at St. Luke's Episcopal, and I was hired to be director of development there. And that started my my journey through schools and really my work in development and philanthropy. I was at St. Luke's for 11 years, really built the development program there. But, you know, by the time I left, I was overseeing marketing, communications, and working with the Board of Trustees to craft strategic plans and then implement those plans. Went to Mary Bird Perkins Cancer Center for 2 years to do fund development there, which was a terrific experience. Loved every minute of that. It was a little hard on me. I have a really soft heart and just sick patients.
We have firsthand experience with that. So,
yes, it was hard. That was a hard thing for me to take emotionally every day. And then from there, went to Parkview. Parkview asked me to come and help them with their fund development program, and ended up about 6 months after I'd been there becoming director of advancement, again overseeing admissions, marketing, communications, and
so that's where you are now. You're still at Parkview.
That's
okay,
because
I know I mentioned the name to you, and Eric, I'm going to leave you out of this, but so I'm actually a product of St. Luke's too, way back when.
That's great.
I think I was four and five at that time.
Terrific.
Still there in the same place, right there on Goodwood.
Yes, absolutely.
So did you know the Reverend Ralph Howell at any point?
I did. I did have occasion to meet him several times. A wonderful man.
He's a Terre High graduate, graduated with me and grew up in your district, as I grew up in the district that you're running for too. So, but you didn't go to St. Luke's, did you? You went to Broadmoor Methodist, I think.
That's correct.
Yes, great program.
I also did not know that you went to St. Luke's.
Well, that's, you know, there's some
learning
secret
something
there,
about
there's
you.
That's good. There's always something to learn, huh? Always.
So, thank you.
Where did you graduate from? Can I ask? Where did you?
I went to high school at St. Joseph's.
Okay, great. Terrific.
So with the academy, then I have a son who graduated from Catholic High, and he and I actually still 18 years, going on 19 now, I think, coach the eighth grade basketball team over there. So you know, it's a good thing to do.
Family tradition.
Yeah, it really is. So, okay, so you mentioned you ran for state representative,
I
think, in the last go-round.
I did. Great experience.
But what did you learn from that you're utilizing now?
Oh, I learned so much. You know, it's so interesting to kind of be on the outside of the political realm and the way you think things are, and you get in, and it's not that at all. I think running for office is one of the most humbling experiences ever, and it's also one of the most energizing because last year I took a grassroots approach to the campaign. So we knocked on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of doors, and I got to talk to hundreds of people that I never, ever would have met. And that's really what got my optimism in full force for the city of Baton Rouge. Because when you go door to door and you talk to just friends and neighbors, they're great people. We live and work around terrific people who wake up every day, feed their family, get dressed, and they head out to work, and they're there to do the best job they can, and get home in the evening, help their kids with homework, and then do the chores they need to do to get up and do it all again the next day. So just that the nobility of the average, what we call the average Baton Rougean, was inspiring to me. And then seeing the people in this city who are born here, have been raised here, who have been through a lot. I feel like this city has been through a lot, and yet they love this city. They're still into their 70s, 80s, still working hard to bring about the quality of life that they want for their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. That is also inspiring to see people who are, they're just not going to give up until their dying day and until they see this community be what they want it to be.
Yeah, I think some of us way back when remember what Baton Rouge was. And look, I'm here. I was actually born in Shreveport. My parents came here. My dad actually played football at LSU and came back. So I've lived here virtually my whole life, and it still is a great city. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not. Yeah. I chose to stay here. We're going to get into Jamie in a little bit about, you know, her group, the millennials, and her age group, and why she came back from Orlando. I think because I think it's important for you too, it's a big group there. And I do know Scott McKnight personally. I know his mother actually grew up down the street. Yes. I know it was a tough race. But I applaud you and anybody that chooses to run for office. That takes a special desire, and obviously you have that. And so anybody that does that. But how – I think we all know the answer to this to a degree, but how has COVID-19 impacted campaigning?
It's impacted everything. You know, we're not going to be able to go door-to-door like we were. We did a few door-to-door this weekend, of course, very cautiously, very carefully, wearing face shields, making sure that, you know, we didn't make anybody uncomfortable. I think it feels like this political season is later getting started. I don't know if you all feel that.
Absolutely.
I think part of that is COVID. I think nobody kind of knows how to be or what to do right now. But there are no big events. So you're either going door to door in kind of a new, strange, distanced way. You know, direct mail is going to be important. Social media is going to be important.
I mean, are you doing social media at all? Have
Absolutely.
You done some? Because I've been on a couple of the, actually, again, I'm throwing names out here, but Senator Bill Cassidy graduated with my wife, Mary Ann, from Tara. He's another Tara grad. It all circles back to Tara when it comes to it. But
I love it.
But he, you know, I think I've got a Zoom call with him, about probably 20 of us. And then there was one with John Kennedy, probably about a month ago. So I think that's at least you get to talk to them a little bit and you get to see them and ask questions and stuff. So have you thought about doing any of that? Because this is a social media expert. I'm not pushing her, but she is.
No, I did a Facebook Live for my kickoff, and I'm going to do a few more Facebook Lives. So I would tell you, this environment, I think you'll probably agree, favors incumbents, because it's really difficult for other people to get their message out there and just to get people's attention too. And I think the distancing thing has also kind of done something maybe emotional or mental to us. We do feel more distant from each other. So I think it's harder to make those connections that we're used to trying to make on campaigns. I'm going to do a few more Facebook Lives and put up some more videos trying to get people to engage. So a lot of this race this year is going to be trying to get name recognition in a very strange environment.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think people are going to vote for the name that they know. And if they see your name more and they get to the ballot and they're like, oh, I know this name, I don't know this name, you know, they're going to pick that one, even if they haven't done their research.
Yeah.
Which obviously I encourage everyone to do your research before you vote, but not everyone
Thank
does.
Thank you, Jamie. Yes.
No, she does. Well, believe me, she does. She's very passionate about that. So, but fortunately, I guess, in your race, the incumbent can't run anymore. He's actually running
that's
for
right.
mayor.
He's running for mayor.
So, and you have two opponents.
Two opponents. That's correct.
So what separates you from them a little bit? I don't know.
Sure. I think just my life experience, my education a little bit, because I've got the master's in public administration. I thought it was bad luck when I was finishing up my master's, and in our public budgeting class, we had to draw budgets. And so our professor, you know, because this is what, you know, professors in public budgeting do, he collected budgets of different municipalities, I mean, from all over the country. So some of them were like itty-bitty skinny, towns you never heard of, and then, you know, New York City or Los Angeles. Well, I thought I was unlucky, and I drew New York City, and it was a huge, massive project that took weeks and weeks and weeks, because we had to analyze the entire budget and write a huge paper on, you know, what we learned about the city and the way things were going and what the trends were. But I will tell you today, I'm glad that I have that experience because I was downloading the parish budget last week, and it's 532 pages.
I saw that.
And it's a little intimidating. It's just because of the sheer size and scope of it. But
it's
somebody
got paid for wordsmithing that thing.
It's huge. They got paid by the
That's what I'm saying. You look at it, you know, you're trying to get to one of the numbers, but there's so much wordsmithing in there before you get to the numbers.
That's true. There is. There's a lot of narrative. But as I was going through, I was like, okay, this feels familiar. This feels like getting on this bike. And I think that's one of the things that's really important to people. As I have talked to people in the last few months, people are concerned. They don't feel like they know where their money's going, and they don't feel
right.
Like they're not feeling the transparency. And you know, maybe it's just a communication issue, or maybe it's something deeper. I don't know. But I'm starting to dig into the budget. I'm looking forward to digging into it more and more and more as time goes on.
Good, because I think it needs some digging into. Again, it's over $1 billion now. And I look at a Birmingham, you know, again, comparable city, and it's less than half of that. I'm not trying to compare the two, but I always thought Birmingham was overall a bigger city. But it's East Baton Rouge Parish budget that you're
We'd have to look
to
at Jefferson
with.
County.
Yeah,
to
you'd
get
have to look at the whole county
apples
versus
apples.
That. So.
But still, it gives you some scale.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
I actually took a leadership class last year, the Barton leadership class, and there was a lot of comparison between Baton Rouge and Birmingham.
Really?
So, yeah, it was like one of our classes was on Baton Rouge's identity and Baton Rouge's, you know, different things like that. And there was a lot of Baton Rouge versus Birmingham and how the two cities are very similar and yet very different. So it's interesting that you have that live experience.
Yeah. Was there anything that stood out to you in particular?
That's a
just
great
out
question.
Of curiosity?
Well, this was over a year ago.
So sure,
yeah. You're young though, Jamie. It's not
COVID
like us.
And lots of things have happened in between.
I'm going to blame this one on COVID memory.
Yes.
How about that?
No, it's okay. Yeah, it's just
nothing stands out to you on
I
that?
Can't remember anything.
Well, I mean, the airport, there's a you know, would be kind of similar. Like we have New Orleans that's just down the road,
right.
And Birmingham has... It has a bigger airport than us, but it's kind of struggled because Atlanta's right there. There's some things that it really matches up. Where it's located geographically probably helps.
I'll do my research after this.
You don't remember
email.
Like
I took
the
notes,
auto, you don't remember like the auto industry now there. Like I think Mercedes-Benz has a manufacturing
outside
facility there, and you know, so, which is Tuscaloosa right near Birmingham, and then there's Auburn on the other side.
It's considered the banking capital of the South.
Do a little research.
Y'all are really putting me on the spot.
Well, I mean, you're the youngest one in the whole group. When your memory starts to go, we're all in trouble.
COVID memory.
I'm telling you.
Because March, April, and May were just so crazy.
I'm still living in March. In my mind, I believe it's still March.
I understand that completely. Believe me, I understand that completely.
All right. Well,
let's just get you to the right place by November the 3rd.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. November 3rd, you have to vote. She will not forget that, believe me, Laura.
I vote every single election.
Okay. So
Yes, me too.
So let's kind of move into the topics, I guess. You know, starting out with crime, you brought it up a little bit, or one of you did, that Baton Rouge, according to this one study by Wallet Hub, found that Baton Rouge was the fourth most unsafe city in the United States. So I'd already done a podcast on defunding the police, which I'm totally opposed to. I'm not against reimagining some of it, but I think we need to pay our police officers more and stuff.
Absolutely.
But what do you think we can do? What are your thoughts on how we can, I don't say improve crime because that's kind of a long term, but reduce crime in Baton Rouge?
Well, I think we have several problems. First, we don't have enough police officers right now. The force is down. And I think that's probably been the case since 2016 and everything that happened. We forget about everything that happened before the flood because the flood really wiped out. But
you remember the flood, Jamie? 2016.
I do. I remember 2016.
But the shootings that took place. Anyway, so terrible time. But you know, I was aware at that point. I was hearing talk that police officers in Baton Rouge were looking. They were looking to move elsewhere. And certainly, that you know, if I were married to a police officer, I would be nervous. It's A very tumultuous time to be a police officer.
So, absolutely.
To me, we are. And the latest, gosh, it's the mayor study. Didn't it say that our police are 30 to 40% underpaid?
I think in my defunding the police podcast, I think they start out at like $37,000 or $38,000, right. and I look at, I'm not taking anything away from teachers. Believe me, I know you're in education.
Sure.
But I just look at police officers out there going and laying their life on the line for us, going in and knocking on that door, or
yes.
just, you know, like in Compton, California, just sitting in their police car and somebody comes up and shoots them. I just, you know, it's, I don't know how they do it every day. And we know several police officers personally. Again, Pat Englade is a personal friend.
Absolutely.
Who was former police chief. I don't know how we even attract people to go into the police department now, but I know
that's
the sheriff's department does pay. Sheriff starting pay is a little bit higher, I think 5,000 or 6,000 at least higher than the city police. So
right.
how do we, and I don't even know what a constable does, I'll be honest.
I think those are really process type things.
I think they're picking up warrants. So do we really need,
yeah.
you know, going back to the budget,
right.
we want to go there, but can,
yeah,
do we really
know.
Need, you know, city constables to, not taking anything away from city constable,
sure.
but I think that money could be better utilized elsewhere.
I think we're going to have to pay. We have to pay our police better to attract police, so that we can fully fill out the force. But then also, you know, to have the kind of people that we want to be police, right? I mean, and that is not a statement on the current police we have.
Right.
I know a number of them who are amazing individuals. God bless them for the work they do. But I had a friend tell me the other day that believe it or not, you can make more. As a per hour starting at McDonald's than you can as a Baton Rouge City police officer.
Probably with the hours that they work, it probably equate to that.
I found that kind of shocking. So clearly we've got to do better by our police. I don't know if you had the opportunity yet to read Malcolm Gladwell's latest book, Talking to Strangers.
I have it downstairs, but I have not. So.
Okay.
I did read that, actually.
I listened
she,
to
she,
it.
She wants
okay.
to open her own bookstore, so she reads. You know, you had the maternity. She
yes.
wants her own bookstore, so.
Mm-hmm. I could own a bookstore,
she reads
too.
Constantly.
That's the answer to fixing Baton Rouge. We just need a bookstore.
And
attract all the people.
Really good bookstore. But I felt like that book gave me hope. Did it give you hope?
It was a fascinating study on a bunch of different things. It was,
data-driven policing that Malcolm Gladwell talks about.
I'll have to go read it.
It's fascinating. So he talks about that they're learning that crime is more tied to place, like particular places, like very small areas.
Right.
Like, so if you have a precinct, you'll see that most of the crime takes place on several streets. And so he makes the case for data-driven policing. And so I think that is probably going to be the direction that we need to go and invest in the technology that our police and our sheriff needs so that we are getting to the root of our crime.
Right.
Not just generally policing large areas, but focusing in.
And I'm in industrial construction, and that's part of, from a safety aspect, that's what we do. I think mm-hmm. Michael even mentioned it in the Defunding the Police podcast about we have a pyramid, and when you start seeing things occurring, then you're looking at the next one. How can we mitigate this rather than, you know, if you have an 3 or 4 or 5 safety incidents, well, then the next one's going to be a recordable, and you have a couple of recordable. Eventually, you're going to get to a fatality,
right.
which none of us want. And I think so you start concentrating on what is the root cause of that. And I think from the standpoint of crime, the data-driven, maybe it could be, let's focus on where the crime mm-hmm. really is. I think the problem now, though, Laurie, is that it's moving out of the bad spot, so to speak, and coming into other areas.
More pervasive.
In what I would have considered the more safe areas of this city. So I think if you start with what you're saying, maybe and looking at that, and what I know poverty, education, all that's going to be part of it.
Absolutely.
It may be it's clearly systemic to a degree from that standpoint, but it may be generational there too. But we've got to give some hope and figure out what the problems are.
I'll tell you, there's also some interesting research that was done in the Netherlands in, I think, 2008 or 2009 that talks, they were researching the litter, debris, general maintenance of a city and graffiti. And they discovered that the more unkempt an area is, the more likely people are to act in a lawless manner. All people more likely to act in a lawless manner. So it sounds like, you know, I hate to even talk about it because it kind of sounds like a woman's campaign issue, but we have to clean up our city. Like our city, we have to have pride in our city. Our city needs to reflect both the quality of people that we have here, but also where we are striving to be, what we are trying to be. And we're missing the mark.
I think it's a great point. I know there's a big campaign on all the time about cleaning up the city. We never get there.
So I get serious about
it. I don't know how people can be driving down the road and throw trash out.
Me neither.
I don't understand that, but it probably does. So you got anything you want to talk about on crime, or you just want to – I'm looking at Jamie here, who's taking a deep breath. And,
I mean, my main point was going to be that poverty begets crime. And so we have to, I'm not the one running for office here, but I think that it's, the problem starts a lot deeper than just crime. And I'm just going to throw this out there because I am a millennial, but I've looked at studies and I just wonder how... legalizing certain drugs and things like that might cut down on a little bit of the crime. I can't say for sure.
No, but. I'm not opposed to some of that, believe it or not, because I think it's being done anyway. And hey, might increase our tax base a little bit. So, yeah. It might help our school system. I think you got to look at Colorado and things and say, okay, what, you know, that since they're already legalized marijuana. Yeah. How is it impacting them? So I think it's a good place to look at and see, kind of like Michael mentioned, maybe with Milwaukee or Minneapolis that wanted to totally wipe out the police and start over, reimagine from scratch. You know, his point was, well, let's let them learn, you know, the pros and the cons, and then maybe we can extrapolate the good parts and bring it here. So I think it's the same. Maybe with I'm not opposed to that, but I'm not running for office either. So.
But I'll tell you this, the reason I didn't go to poverty, people in this community, when we talk about poverty, they start to feel hopeless. And so I found that in those discussions, people just kind of throw up their hands like, we don't know what to do. We don't. Yeah. So I've been trying to focus on just the things that we know where we could make an impact. I mean, certainly education is a key to poverty and ending poverty. And I'll tell you this. I think we've really failed a full generation of students by having our high school, our academic programs, trying to prepare every child for the college path.
Absolutely.
God did not make us all to be the same. There are multiple paths to productive, worthy lives that contribute to society and make families stronger and communities stronger. So I'm a big proponent of technical training and just different paths to education. I mean, you know, nowadays there are a lot of kids who go into IT who don't have college degrees and go on to have very successful technology careers or creative careers. So I think we have we've told a generation of kids, hey, yeah, if you weren't going to college, you just weren't worthy, and that's wrong.
I think we're trying to work on that. I actually sit on a couple of committees or commissions, so to speak, that Louisiana Construction Education Foundation is one of them, where we're actually giving grants to certain high schools for technical training.
Absolutely.
Have you ever been to the Associated Builders and Contractors Training Center out there?
I have not.
You need to get out there. I mean, I'm heavily involved in that. It is the technical aspect where we are teaching, and Jamie's been out there, I think, but okay, that's great.
I'm realizing y'all can't see me nodding my head.
No, I saw you nodding. They can. You know,
we're
not YouTubing
the
this.
The listeners can't see me.
But
nod.
We are we are training electricians, pipe fitters, welders. We're even now moving more into the commercial construction aspects of training some of the carpenters and stuff. And it's giving these kids
absolutely
hope. And along what you're saying, the lines of what you're saying, I'll never, ever forget this. And I've mentioned it a couple of speeches and stuff that I've given was through this LCEF, we gave a $50,000 donation to the Ascension Parish school system. My good friend David Alexander, it always circles back to Tara, David, when you listen to this. But we gave it, and there were some students there. And I remember this mother coming up afterwards. You know, we had the big check and the pictures and all that. And this mother comes up and says, y'all don't know what you've done for my son. You've given him hope. Wow. Because, you know, he's now in the electrical program. Had he not done that, he would have dropped out of school. He was a 10th grader. I mean, she was crying, wow, so to speak. And so I think that's what we've got to do. And we're starting to try and identify just exactly what you're saying. Not everybody's made for college. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted to work with his hands. Absolutely. And that's what he's doing. And now he's probably making more than quite a lot of people out there. So, you know, it's a good living and he's happy you know, potential to move up. But I would encourage you, and we may get you out there, because I'm trying to get David Tapman out there as well, to go see what it's about. I mean, I will tell you, we bring kids in from Ascension Parish. East Baton Rouge Parish, for some reason, the school board doesn't really want to work with us that much. We bring kids in from Central, which is outside of that school board now. Those kids come in. We've got some even from Avoyelles Parish every now and then will come in. But it's those kids that really want to learn a trade. And like I told them, you know, once you learn that trade, you can take it anywhere. You can go to Maine or Wyoming. They can't take that away from you. Yep. So it's very important for that. So,
absolutely.
All right, let's move on to economic development. You don't want to talk about that? That was Jamie, by the way, not Laurie. But, you know, I'll tell you, and I'll ask it in a sense that I've traveled around this country quite a bit. And usually when I go into a city or a town that I'm not familiar with, I know the name or something, but I'll ask some of the locals, what is the driving economic force for, you know, Phoenix isn't hard, but, you know, some others. Birmingham, I know, yeah, it's financial, but I'm trying, like Kansas City, okay, to a degree. I mean, I know part of it. But what is the driving economic force? For me, Baton Rouge is very simple. Mm-hmm. We're petrochemical. Mm-hmm. We've got state government and local government.
I do.
And we've got Southern University and LSU. And so with three of those are government entities, which, you know, goes back to your tax dollars, so to speak. But how do we drive the economy? And I'm in the industrial construction business, mm-hmm, so petrochemicals been, you know, our livelihood.
Right.
But we've got to diversify, I think, within our economic aspects. And Jamie, you know, again, she's somewhat in the film industry to a degree, involved with it. What are your thoughts on what else can we do to get new business and diversify?
Well, I love the film industry, and I really do hope it's coming back, because that to me made so much sense for Baton Rouge. And because it's a beautiful area, it's a unique area, it's a great culture, lots of talent to draw on for the film industry. That's a great question, and I don't know that I have any brilliant brand new ideas to offer, other than just getting our city to be, you know, I think one of the things that people love about Baton Rouge is that it still has this small town atmosphere with all of the bigger community amenities, or a lot of them. Probably not the same as Orlando, but I mean, still, I mean, it's, we've got,
we don't have Disney World, but
we don't, not the same as Orlando, but we do, you know, you can kind of have a little bit of the best of both worlds here. And so I think if we can get our quality of life issues right, I mean, companies care about their people. Companies want to be in communities where their you know, their employees will have a great family life, a great community life. So, you know, I don't know that I really have a particular industry in mind.
I don't think there's a particular industry, but I just, you know, I look at like even the Pennington Biomedical Center. I think we could really expand on that.
That's a great idea.
I know we've got the emerging, I guess, medical corridor over there between Bluebonnet and Essen now that we're trying to grow. You were involved with Mary Bird Perkins, which I think has become a really good regional cancer center.
Yeah.
You know, still, I think has a ways to go, but I think for the region, it's really good. But and they're growing, and I mean, I know some people that have been heavily involved with that too. In fact, after this is over, I'll give you some more names that you'll probably know very well.
Oh, great.
But from that aspect.
So, but we have a Research One institution here. I mean, LSU is a Research One.
Right.
And that definitely brings brilliant minds here. We just need to make sure that we keep funding for our universities steady so that we don't lose those talented minds to other communities. But there are applied science, applied research.
Right.
It is a great possibility for here, just as long as we just got to be stable. That's, I think, our biggest challenge is to be, because, you know, business needs predictability. So every bit of predictability we can offer.
Yeah, and I think back to your quality of life with the companies. I think it even attracts more, you know, employees coming here. I mean, I've seen it where, oh, you're moving to Baton Rouge, like even, you know, say ExxonMobil's got an engineer in Houston, or you're going to be transferred to Baton Rouge. Baton Rouge? What?
Yeah.
Back to Jamie's point about her friend maybe wanting to move to Texas with kids, because they've got all public schools over there.
Right.
And they may have 4,000 students in the school, but they're very good public schools. And so here, you're right. It's going to be, hey, I'm going to go to, I remember we coached one of the refinery manager's sons in basketball. He mm-hmm. was at Catholic, or they might go to Episcopal, or they might go to Dunham or Parkview.
Right.
Instead of putting them in the public school system. And like you said, that's suddenly, depending on how many kids, that could be $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 that off the bat, they're in the hole. So we've got to improve that aspect. But, I mean, how do you feel about, and this is a little bit on the film industry, but I think also, again, the driving force for the most part is the petrochemical industry, about tax exemptions or you know, tax incentives and stuff for those industries, because sure. I know there's controversy on both sides.
Right. Well, I think, you know, we can't pretend like we live in a bubble. We're going to need to do similar things to what other states do, because we are competing with other states. So we're competing with ourselves, because we've got to be able to offer a stable process, an understandable process, and a very professional process for people to apply for the ITEP program. But then it's a market. It's a market just like any other market, which means we need to understand what the entire market across the country is, what our position in that market is, and how we best position ourselves to both, you know, bring jobs to Baton Rouge, but then also to have the tax base that we need to provide the kind of city services and the kind of quality of life that we want here in Baton Rouge. So
let's go to tax base real quick.
Sure.
That was a little bit down, but just, you know, I showed you something before we started the podcast, and it was really about, and I encourage anybody to go there. It's East Baton Rouge Parish Assessor's Geo Portal, where you can click on any address within Baton Rouge and see what the tax implications, property tax implications are for that particular address. Mm-hmm. And so what I showed you was, you know, one particular house, and then across the street was another, and it was less than half almost of the one across the street from it. And then we moved to another area of town, and it was similar. So
yeah.
I don't think we need more taxes, so to speak.
Right.
I think we just need to, and I think commercial, from what I understand, is even more or not getting nearly as much taxes as we could, you know, contributing to the tax base as it could. So I think we just really need to take a good look at that. I think the money's here. It's just that we need to be fair and equitable about
right.
it.
Right, absolutely, and transparent, yeah.
So
I mean, I love the transparency that you can just get on there and look and see.
Right.
And from reading some Nextdoor posts in the last week or two since the assessments, the reassessments
right.
have come
right.
out, multiple people have been going and looking at well-known people's houses in Baton Rouge to see.
Well, I need another ad. I don't
see.
Yeah, but no, that's, yeah, but you're right.
And so I don't know if that is the updated information, because people, like I said, on the Nextdoor app were identifying some inequities or some things that they felt like were out of
right.
out of bounds, properties that you know had sold for millions but were now, you know, assessed at a much lower rate.
Well, we'll clarify. We're not absolutely certain that.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the new assessments have come out, but right. but this was 2 or 3 years ago when I started looking at this.
Right.
So it's and I think, you know, you may not be able to increase but a certain percentage every year, every 2 or 3 years when they do the assessments.
Yes.
But I'm still going to be here, whereas that one's still going to be here. They're never going to cut, you know, we're never going to be equal. And I'm using that as an example that this house versus this house. You know, when you're half,
right.
I don't think that the disparity is really great there. So I guess my point is, I think we've got enough money within the city from a tax base standpoint. We just got to start. And you said transparency too. I think that so, but
it's gotta be fair. So it makes me wonder if the differences relate to when the property was sold.
That's probably part of it to a degree.
There's gotta be a way to adjust. You know, it kind of reminds me of where we are with our state budget and the fact that I can't remember the numbers, but we have a huge spending limit on our state funds. Because when all of the Katrina funds, the federal funds and insurance funds, flowed into the state, it expanded our state budget
tremendously,
and that caused a skew in the formula for the state spending ceiling that has just continued on. And so there's an amendment on the ballot this time, Amendment 4, that has been placed on the ballot to readjust that. So
good thinking, we need that. So
But you're making me think that there may need to be some mechanism, you know, for some kind of adjustment.
I just ask that you look at that. Once you're
absolutely
elected, I ask that you look at that.
I think we need to get the assessor in here for a podcast. I think I see the next show teed up right there. I like that idea. So,
okay. All right.
We'll both sit in, too. Yeah.
Well, you know, just bought a new house, so you're getting ready to feel that impact really quick.
Yeah. So not looking forward to that part.
Is that your first house? That?
It's my second, but it's the first one that I, you know.
Yeah. Congratulations. Yeah,
thank you.
First was a townhome. Now she's in a house.
It's my first
by
real
herself.
House.
So, you got a yard to cut. You have, yes.
She has someone to cut the yard. So,
yeah, that's great.
But he's a great, Maybe we'll get him on one day. Sure. He'd be an interesting character. So, you know, and I look at your website and you have the, you know, the crime and the education, but you know, infrastructure as well.
It's
and
the problem.
You know, it's a big problem.
It is.
And I will tell you when I'm coming in on I-12, From the east, I always know I'm in Baton Rouge when I get almost over. Well, I get maybe 2 miles within the parish line, past O'Neill. My car just starts jumping because, and I know that may be state or federal, but still, it is just. I mean, people coming into this state, going trying to track people, and they hit that.
Yeah, it's
this
a problem.
Is Baton Rouge, and the drainage and everything.
Absolutely.
So.
Infrastructure statewide. We have problems statewide.
What are your thoughts on that as far? How can we, again, it's a great city, but we've got crime, we've got infrastructure problems. We've got a lot to do here.
We do. I think we need to get back to basics. I think government has taken on mission creep, which is one of the things that nonprofit and governmental entities do. But my view of government is that government does the things that private industry cannot do. And certainly infrastructure is one of those things. So I think we need to get really serious about focusing in on what are the things that Baton Rouge Parish government can do that there's nobody else who is going to do, has responsibility for doing. And then we've got to have plans. We've got to have priorities, plans, and then we've got to have collaboration. And I think that's one of my frustrations with local government is that people don't seem to be working together.
Exactly.
And that's a frustration. It's time. I say every time I give a talk, there are no Republican and no Democrat potholes. They're just potholes. There has got to be a way for reasonable people who are serving the people and placing politics to the sides to come up with a plan to move Baton Rouge forward and fix the things we need to fix. I mean, $1 billion is a lot of money.
Right? It's an absolute for a city the size of Baton Rouge or even as Baton Rouge Parish. And you're right. I think that's great. We got to have a plan. We got to have priorities. And maybe that's part of what Move BR is going to do is I think that's part of it. But you know what, Lori, I remember my dad complaining, this was back in the late 60s, I think, about they just come out with a sewer user fee in the 60s. And it was supposed to last maybe 5, 6, 7 years.
Oh, yeah.
We're in 2020 now, and it's still there, and the sewer system is still not fixed the way it needs to be. That's my concern.
Absolutely.
Is that it's perpetual, and nobody's really, you can't see the end of the tunnel there. It's just perpetual. We're going to keep charging this. And look, I again, another little fee and not a tax, but it's a tax.
It is a tax.
But we're still working on the sewer system. And I think it's increasing every year. So that's what I think we got to prioritize and start saying, okay, you know, it's like when you build a plant.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, you got to pour the foundation before you've got to weld the pipe together and you've got to erect it and stuff before we insulate it, so to speak, which is part of my area. But you can see it being done. You can see building a house. You see, here's the end. I think in government with infrastructure, it's going to be ongoing, but always. We've got to see improvements, and I just don't see a whole lot of improvements right now.
Always. And you are not the first person to mention the sewer user fee to me.
Really?
There are multiple people who have concerns about the sewer user fee and the fact that
it's not. Do you
even
know what that is?
I'm sure I've paid it, but didn't pay attention to it. But, I mean, I don't know why y'all are sitting here saying this. I'm just wondering, where's the money going? Like you're saying, we're paying
the
all these taxes. We're paying.
Yeah.
Where is it going? It's not just disappearing. It's $1 billion.
I will show you later on the East Baton Rouge Parish budget for 2020.
I pulled it up the other day.
Well, you will be amazed at some of the money that and I'm not going to get into specifics here because this is her time. But it some of it just blew me away. I mean, what's budgeted now? Not all of it will necessarily be spent because it's a budget.
Right.
But when you got $250,000 for this in the budget. That should be somewhere else.
We can do another episode on that.
We can do another
episode. And go through the budget.
There we go.
I'm seeing lots of podcasts in the future. I love it.
I hope you're writing these down, Dad.
All right. No, real quick, again, you've had people. I just think there's a lot of skepticism out there from an infrastructure standpoint. So you've had other people mention the sewer
user fee. I literally have had other people say that they know that some of the sewer user fees, or they believe, are going to purposes that it was not originally intended. So again, mission creep, you know.
Yeah.
Was it originally for this, but now, oh, well, this is just one off, or this is two offs, or, well, this makes sense, or we need this money. Yeah. So I'm definitely one of the things that I'm going to have to dig into.
Okay, well, good. So we're going to go through a couple more, and then we'll kind of wrap it up.
Sure.
But so education. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, because, again, we've got the school board. But I think a lot of people think that the city council, the metro council, as it's called now, has a lot to do with education. I mean, is there, and you're in education field, so to speak. Is there anything you think that the metro council can do to help improve education?
I think the thing the metro council needs to do is just set the tone for the entire city. And that's of professionalism and excellence, transparency of making plans. Explaining to people what those plans are, and that takes cooperation, collaboration. That takes a lot of discussions. I think we need to be open to talking on a regional level about economic development, about traffic solutions, about drainage solutions. We've got to step up and lead, and as people insist on excellence in themselves and raise the bar. For themselves, the bar, it gets raised for everybody. And so I think that's probably the way the Metro Council can really lead. I think right now people see dissension. People tell me, the Metro Council, they just yell at each other. And whoever yells the loudest is the one who wins the vote. Now, whether that, you know, is fair fair.
I do watch it every now and then. But I think the same can be said of the school board. You know, again, David Tapman's on there. I know a couple of others. And I know several people on the city council right now that I think you're right. It is, and we're going to eventually get to that, but I think that is part of the problem we've got to get through.
The leaders can't keep dividing. The leaders have got to bring everybody together. They've got to come together themselves, and form relationships, friendships. And then use that understanding. I think we've spent a lot of time, and probably for most of your lifetime, but not for ours, just talking about differences. We just day after day after day talk about all the ways we're different. And I'll never forget. I didn't really understand what it meant, but now I do. When I was a young girl in Birmingham, my dad would always say, "Sweetie, everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time." And I was like, why are we saying that? What does that mean? But I've come to understand now that I'm 50 years old, that it means that we have way more in common than we have differences. And so as we focus on the things that bring us together, the things we share, the things where we can agree, we'll build relationships and understanding, and then be able to move forward to have hard conversations and make hard choices.
I think that's a great point. Find the commonality, yes. and then start from there. And then what are the work on the differences? Yes. I think you're right. Do you think that the Metro Council, I know the school board did this, East Baton Rouge Parish School Board did this, they went away, correct, for some kind of two-day get-together, away from everybody to really learn each other, and...
I don't think all of them did, but...
All of them did? I know David. Did David go or not?
I'm not sure.
Well, I think it might be good for the Metro Council, once the new elections take place, let's get away from, and the paper doesn't, they're going to try,
right?
You know, wait a minute, is this open meeting laws, this or that? Let's get past that for once, and let you, because you're having almost 50% turnover, if not a little bit more.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of new people coming in.
People.
Y'all need to learn each other.
Absolutely.
And you're not going to learn each other sitting there with the press and people screaming at you.
Absolutely.
So I think that might be something to look at, is, okay, let's, wherever it may be, let's just get away for a couple of days, learn each other, find the commonalities.
Absolutely.
And then have discussion. So,
yeah, absolutely.
All right. Kind of moving probably towards the last topic here, and then we'll wrap it up. But tourism. So, you know, Baton Rouge, I mean, New Orleans, we know what it's got. Birmingham, even go to Five Points and all those great places.
Right,
plus the Alabama, the Gulf Coast,
right.
the courses and stuff out there, the Robert Trent Jones Trails. But I'm going to let Jamie tell you a little story that occurred, I guess, a couple of weeks ago with you and your mother. And I found it rather interesting. Maybe we'll put you on the spot, Lori, and see what your answers may be.
Okay. So, a couple of weekends ago, we were in Florida, and my mom and I were standing outside of a restaurant waiting to get takeout food. We ended up spending about an hour outside that restaurant. But while we were there, there was another woman, and she was there from Nashville. She was on vacation as well. And I said, so tell me, if I go to Nashville, what are the top three things that I have to do? Mm-hmm. And she just starts spouting off all this stuff, all these restaurants I need to go to, all these shows I need to see, all these different things I need to do. And I'm sitting there taking notes in my phone, like, if I ever go to Nashville, I'm going to do these things. And then she turns the question around on me and says, what are the top three things I need to do in Baton Rouge? And my mom and I just kind of looked at each other and we're like, we have the tallest state capitol building in the country, LSU football. You know, it was hard to come up with things.
Yeah, festivals, Mardi Gras.
And that's what, you know, my brother John, when we were talking about it over dinner that night, he's like, well, you got this festival, you got that festival. I'm like, yeah, but you have to be in the city for the right time to be able to do those things. And so we're trying to come up with ideas for what will attract people to Baton Rouge.
And maybe that's part of the problem, because I started thinking after they said that too. And again, I grew up here, and then I'm going, okay, Tiger Stadium, that's seven nights of women, you know, seven nights out of the year. That's really not, you got to want to come to the football game. You know, we got the LSU Museum, the Rural Life Museum. We have the USS Kid, and I've never been to either one.
Right.
That's a shame that I've never been to either one. But
let me just throw out there that the USS Kidd is now going to be a much bigger attraction since it's been in the movie Greyhound.
Oh, that's true. See, so you're
awesome. There,
that's a little plug for the movie industry there. Yeah, great.
I think so, the movie industry is a huge factor in tourism, and people come to Louisiana for, I want to see where Steel Magnolias was filmed, and I want to see, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, I had to get my film plug in here at some point. But
we did drive through Natchitoches and spotting the different houses for Steel Magnolias. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah. That is a huge driver of tourism for Louisiana, and I hope that it continues to grow the more that we film here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what not putting you on the spot, but I am, what are your maybe top three? If somebody's sitting there from Nashville or wherever and saying, you know, what places should I go to in Baton Rouge? We got great food, we've got this, but where would you suggest that they go?
I would say it's a great place for history buffs. We do have some great museums. The new Louisiana State Museum downtown is, I think, fascinating and well done and very friendly for children. the River Road, although that's, you know, that's painful. It's painful history for a lot of people. It is history.
Oh, absolutely.
The craftsmanship is amazing. You know, it is painful, but some of the homes have done a good job of telling the story, of slavery,
right,
and what it was like. And, you know, I think that's important that we don't run away from that, but that we look at the hard things. What I tell people in Birmingham is definitely you want to go on an airboat tour. You just want to experience the wildlife. The beauty here is different than anywhere else. It's not traditional beauty. It's not mountains. It's not beach. It's swamp. And it's incredible. Birds, you know, your bird watchers, I mean, Audubon, you know, was here for a reason.
Right behind me, so yeah, we.
So it's different. I think it's nature, and I think it's history for us. But yeah, it's not going to be what Nashville is.
But that's not going to drive our economy, so to speak. But I just thought I would that in. Visit Baton Rouge. I mean, Paul Arrigo will call me every now and then for a group that I sit on the board. Used to sit on the board. I keep telling him now I'm not sitting on the board. It's a regional association, and he says, "Why don't y'all have your convention in Baton Rouge?" And I'm thinking, what am I going to tell all these people? You know, we'll go to Austin, Texas, which I really love, and Nashville, I think, is where they were supposed to go this year. Some other places, we've been out to California, and I'm thinking, how can I convince 300 people
to come to
Baton Rouge for a week? And I know they bring in some tourists and have some conventions here. I don't see that as a driving economic force, so to speak. So
yeah, it feels like a day or two on a trip. Throughout Louisiana, we would be a stop, not a destination.
Yeah,
so I agree with that.
All right, so let's kind of move towards wrapping it up. You know, just maybe a couple of more questions, and I think one specifically with Jamie sitting here, the millennials. I mean, how do we attract and keep the younger generation here? I was asking her why she was still here. You know, she went to UCF. Why did she come back to Baton Rouge? You want to go ahead and say why you came back to Baton Rouge or staying here?
I mean, the main reason is family, which is sad to say. You know, why? I wish I could give something a little bit more concrete, but when you were talking earlier, it made me think. You said the people here are different, and that's true. That's absolutely true. We, you know, this is a small town, big city. Our running joke in the family is that everywhere we go, my dad knows somebody and has to go up and talk to him. And, you know, this is a fairly big city for him to be able to do that in. And I think the people are different here in a good way. So that does keep me here too, Dad.
No, I know. But, I mean, you got a lot of friends here. But Laurie, how do you see, again, keeping the LSU and Southern graduates here in Baton Rouge and others that come in and want to stay? How do you do that?
Well, it's jobs and opportunities. I mean, let's be honest. Now, I will tell you this. The most wonderful thing is to be here for your family. I mean, that is, there's nothing better. So you'll never regret being here because of your family. So I've lost both my parents in the last 5 years. And it was hard. I'm happy I've been in Baton Rouge. I've loved being in Baton Rouge, and I've loved raising my children in Baton Rouge. But I'll tell you, after my parents passed, I had regrets, you know, that I hadn't lived any period of time with them in Birmingham, really, since I graduated from high school. So just to let you know, from the 50-year-old view, you're making a really good choice. I think it's jobs. I think it's opportunities. I think it's smart growth neighborhoods where people, you know, you look at Roseanne, the houses are coming back closer. People are on their front porches. They're getting to know each other. It's community.
It's the way it used to be. Yeah.
Yeah. It's community. I mean, that's what makes us, that's what makes us and different. And I think, I don't want to, I mean, I would certainly like to bring elements of other places here, but I don't want to be anybody else. I want to be the best Baton Rouge that we can be. So I think that is a an entrepreneurial friendly. I think I messed it up. But anyway, no, I think it's being friendly to entrepreneurs and innovators. Some of that can be done at the Metro Council level. A lot of that needs to be done at the state legislative level. Our tax code is a mess. And so a lot of businesses don't want to open up here, or they leave here because that these small businessmen are killing themselves trying to maintain a business here with our very complex tax code, and they can go, you know, one state over and have a much easier work life just because of taxes.
Right.
So
right.
There are a lot of things that we can do, especially I think at the state level, to make Louisiana overall a friendlier place for creative and innovative people.
Okay, great.
Which millennials are, y'all are. So
maybe
creative
for
innovative.
Somebody who wants to open a bookstore, you know?
In for your bookstore. When I was in high school, that was what we would do. We're so geeky, even in college. Friday nights and Saturday nights, like, we may go out to have dinner, and then we went to the bookstore and just perused the books and
now
sit
I see
and
why
read.
You were SGA president. You weren't out there partying. You were over there.
I wasn't. No. I'm telling
she's
you.
She's not going to go anywhere. We need her.
And look, Elliott's bookstore.
What
was
your campaign?
Was that weird? Yeah.
What was your campaign for SGA president, by the way?
Oh, for the students was our tagline. So just letting people know we were going to be
You remember
be
who
focused.
You ran against? Who was your opponent in that one? I'm just curious
That's
if you can.
That's a great question. I think Chris Warner and James Lee. Chris Warner went on to write a book about tailgating in the SEC.
I remember him so well. Yeah. Well, then if you beat him, you did really well. So
Stephen Morey was president a couple of years after me. Jimmy Lalonde, who's an orthopedic in town, was president the year after me.
And then I think Garrett Graves' sister was a little bit
Angel
before you.
Grace was a couple of years. Terry Lynn Bush. There's some really, really impressive. So Steve Carter, who's running for mayor, was an SGA president. Jay Darden was an SGA president.
Yeah. Boy, you know them all. Uh-huh. I guess you almost have a little get together.
We
now have to do it Zooming now.
We haven't much anymore, but we used to have an annual meeting at homecoming every year.
Oh, there you go.
And that was really neat, especially when I was young. When I was your age, and I would go to those meetings. It was so cool to see.
I didn't know Steve was SGA president.
He was. Wow. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Good old Steve.
So. Mm-hmm, great guy.
All right. Well, look, I really appreciate you coming on the Freeman Report. Any final thoughts or comments from you?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for doing this. Like I said, I think we've got a full slate planned out for the rest of your podcast. It's needed. I'm excited to have gotten to meet y'all. I'm glad you're here, Jamie.
Thanks.
Up on Baton Rouge and don't give up on Louisiana.
I will not.
Don't give up ever on the people of Louisiana, right? Haven't we lived that out? And haven't we seen that? We're going to find a way no matter what. So
I think that's a great way to put it. Yeah, we are.
We
will. And
out.
I think when people are hurting elsewhere, I promise you, and you know, our hearts go out to both the Southwest Louisiana people that were impacted by Laura and you know, the Alabama and Florida coast right now, and Mississippi too, getting pounded by, what's the name of this storm?
Sally.
And what's the name of the next one out there?
It's Teddy, which is the name of my dog.
So, all right. Well, look, Laurie, I really appreciate it. Best of luck. And maybe once you're elected, we'll have you back on.
I would love that.
Look, again, you can hear the Freeman Report on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio. It's really been great, and looking forward to the next one. Thanks, Laurie.
Thank you. All right. That was terrific. That was fun.
Yeah, no, that was great.